Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Yo, yo, welcome to the Forum Club. I am your co-host, Jovan Buha, joined on the weekly edition of the podcast by Bill Oram and Anthony Slater. Gentlemen, how are you doing today?
Good, man. You coming up to Sacramento, right?
Yeah, I'm making heaven the up trip there. Upstate.
Yes, it's been a cool week for like the LA Bay rivalry, right? I mean, like obviously Lakers Warriors has no stakes, but just having those games going on simultaneously to this big Dodgers Giants series, I thought the environment in Chase Center on Friday night was cool. They were showing the Giants highlights during timeouts, and even last night they were doing that a little bit with the Dodgers. So I don't know. Can we stoke this LA Bay rivalry a little bit more than it has been in recent years?
Yeah, we got it on multiple levels, which is just fun. Multiple levels that are happening simultaneously with huge stars, and like you said, in the NLDS, huge stakes where you got arguably the two best teams in baseball going at it kind of early in the postseason. So it's I don't know. It's fun. I've heard a lot of people from LA complaining about Bay Area weather and having candlestick like conditions at Dodger Stadium for game three. Like, I don't know. I feel like the just Northern Cal, Southern Cal rivalry is getting reheated.
Yeah, it felt like the Bay Area this weekend in LA. I wasn't loving it. I was down there. I was hoping for 82 and breezy, but it was kind of wild in Dodger Stadium. But they came for Staples Center talk, right?
Yeah. I think it'd be great for the league if the Lakers Warriors becomes a rivalry.
Well, it's going to be great for the league if it happens only because like you've got these two teams that are kind of the anchors of this half of the decade, right? Or like of, half a dozen seasons in the conference. And due to the injuries that the Warriors have had, they've so far kind of missed each other, with the exception of last year in the play-in Let's be honest. I mean, the Warriors were kind of in a different place than the Lakers last year, where the Lakers had to get in. The Lakers were, still title contenders at that point. They had to get into the playoffs, and the Warriors were kind of still just a fun, feel good, exceeding expectation story behind that historic campaign from Steph. I mean, I don't think anybody was looking at them as a title contender, even if they'd gotten in.
What's funny about that, though, is I'd love to see, and it's probably out there, like what the ratings for that play-in game were compared to ratings for like the NBA Finals games. I mean, that was probably a top five playoff game from a ratings perspective. And that's the funny thing. It isn't just the Warriors, Lakers, two brands, the California rivalry. It's Steph LeBron. Steph LeBron are the two biggest ratings draws in the league. I mean, this was when it was Warriors Cavaliers, the league loved it. So now you add the Lakers brand into that same rivalry, potentially in the same conference. I think the league would beg for a Warriors Lakers West Finals, particularly, but really any playoff series between those two, they would love.
So, yeah, I hope we get it at least once. I mean, it's kind of the same point we've made in the past about Lakers Clippers. You've kind of got the Lakers and the Clippers finally, contenders at the same time, and yet they've continued to miss each other in the postseason. At some point, the fact that they both exist in the same market deserves the payoff of an actual series. And same with the Lakers and Warriors, kind of at the height of kind of their powers. I mean, you could argue the Warriors aren't there anymore, and that the Lakers may not get there again. We don't know, but I mean, they are both still just such huge deals that I think we as sports fans deserve it.
So we're recording this on Wednesday morning. The Lakers and Warriors played last night for the second time in the preseason. Warriors won 111-99. We're basically at the goal line of the preseason. The regular season is less than a week away. The Lakers are 0-5. I don't think anybody predicted them to go undefeated, but 0-5, I think, has been a little surprising, even with the guys in and out of the lineup. Is there any cause for concern with this preseason start? Does it even matter? Or where are you guys at on the panic meter? Because I got my first fire Frank Vogel tweet last night, which really surprised. I'm like, of all the people to blame, I think Frank's towards the bottom of the list. But I guess Anthony, as kind of a you know, third party coming in, you know, seeing a couple of games with the Lakers, like what has stood out in terms of just how this kind of dysfunctional they've been on both ends so far?
By the way, that's an earlier firing calling than my guy Mike Brown. How many games did he get? He got like eight or so.
Five?
Yeah, five regular season games.
Five.
I mean, they were 0-5 and they lost all.
So what you're saying is this is trending in a Mike Brown-y direction right now for Frank Vogel. I don't want to sit here and be like panic about the entire season, but I think the first subject and probably a long topic we should have is Russell Westbrook. I would be concerned about Russell Westbrook's play. I don't know, Jovan, if you have the stats in front of you, but what is he shooting? Like 20% with like 20 turnovers in three games or something like that?
I was pulling it up as you were talking.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously just the to me, and you could see it over the years, back to his prime in Oklahoma City when he was just devastating at the rim. He was finishing over bigs. He was dunking all that. Year by year, you know, his finishing at the rim has gone down. And you could just see he knows that now. And he's trying to pass off more. Sometimes he's getting to the rim and he's almost trying to like, hey, let me try to slip this pass through a double team right now to AD and like set him up. And it's like people don't fear him at the rim as much, so that people's hands are more in passing lanes and he's turnover prone. The jump shot is not what it used to be. I mean, you know, he has stretches, obviously, when he can hit some jumpers, but he's been bricking in preseason. And then the defense, I mean, if you go look at most of the Warriors' threes last night, I mean, it's just like Russell Westbrook breakdowns, really.
There was one clip I saw that was like in slow-mo. Jovan, I don't know. Did you show me this?
Yeah, I saw it as well. Oof. I know what you're talking about.
Is this the Damian Lee clip?
No, well, it actually was. I believe Damian Lee was involved, but it isn't the Damian Lee taking him off the dribble. It's Damian Lee standing without the ball in the corner and then like bolting up to take like kind of curl off a screen on the wing. And he doesn't even react to Damian Lee moving from the corner until Damian Lee like has the ball on the wing. And he's like, oh, shit.
And he's he's in a shooting motion. And then Russ sort of lunges. But at that point, he's 12 feet away. So it's like it's a contest, but like, you know, you'd need to have Inspector Gadget arms and Kawhi hands to have any shot at it.
Has always been the story of him defensively, where it's like, sure, if you just look at the physical profile, I mean, he looks like, you know, as good a defensive guard in the league. I mean, because obviously lateral quickness has always been there. Strength is top of his class among his peers, but it's the off ball airheadedness at times, the gambling at times, and then just like he'll just die on screens, like just because he wanted to, I guess. I mean, there was one last night where Bielitsa came down to set a screen. It wasn't some like thunderous screen. He just kind of sat on it, and then Otto Porter just goes up to the wing, and I guess he expects some help, but it's like, I don't know, if you don't try to hustle over a screen, it's just, to me, it's just type of shit that Frank Vogel's not going to like.
Well, and there's also just not that there aren't enough people to cover for him either. Like defensively, the Lakers don't have the defensive personnel to compensate for Russ's weaknesses. I mean, and maybe that's going to be different when the regular season starts, if they go big and they start DeAndre Jordan. And so you at least have that backline defense of DeAndre and Anthony Davis, which kind of seems to be the way things are trending, which is an interesting sort of litmus test of what the Lakers view as their biggest problem with Russell Westbrook. And overall, is their biggest problem with that opening lineup spacing, or is it the lack of perimeter defense? And without Trevor Ariza, without Talen Horton-Tucker, if you go big, to me, it is a concession that your defensive liabilities are of greater concern than your spacing liabilities.
That is a great point. I think you nailed it, because I kind of came away from yesterday just thinking like, it would be interesting to see what this group would look like with DeAndre out there, because Frank Vogel talked about it after the game. The Warriors were running a lot of back cuts against the Lakers and kind of catching them, you know, in miscommunication and mistiming. And I think some of that is having two minus defenders in Carmelo Anthony and Russell Westbrook in that starting group. So I think that's where a DeAndre Jordan or Dwight Howard with those guys, you know, adding size, rim protection, length would help. But on the opposite end, there were spacing concerns. And I went back on Synergy and kind of went through each player's, you know, shots and just sort of where they were getting the ball, where they were taking shots. And, you know, several of Russ's threes just came from his defender completely cheating off of him. And, you know, there's one play where AD gets the ball on the right elbow. Russ is kind of spotting up in between the top of the arc and the wing. And Andre Iguodala just is cheating over and continuing to cheat more and more, and basically goes to like trap AD. He kicks it to Russ. Russ misses an open three. And like, those are the plays that the Lakers are going to have to kind of figure out. And that's maybe honestly a situation where Russ should cut to the basket instead of spotting up, because I think that's where you get him head of steam going to the rim. I like that version of Russ more than him spotting up in a catch and shoot situation. But I think the one thing that has been concerning to me more, like the shooting, he looks rusty. I think some of that stuff is just going to take some time. And we know he's now played for four teams in 4 years. And in each situation he has, or at least in the two new situations in Houston and Washington, he was better around the All-Star break and beyond. So I think for us, there's going to be an adjustment period. But the thing that's been concerning to me is I think the shot selection has progressively gotten worse. And if you look at the first Golden State game, you know, only five attempts, but no threes. And I thought he just was looking to pass and play make more. He kind of said after the, you know, he needs to look for a shot more, and defenses are playing him to pass. And since then, you've seen, I think, some of the bad habits of just pull up mid-range jumpers in transition, or you know, him maybe being open, but a teammate also being open and him still taking the shot, but when it's a lower percentage shot. So that to me is more the concerning thing, is I think, as you know, we kind of, everyone puts on their best impression in a new situation, but you know, at what point does Russ just become Russ and, you know, take the shots that he's been chastised for years now? And that's already kind of started to happen. And I guess that would be my kind of only major concern, like projecting out, is just, I think it's hard to change him. And he is starting to kind of look at times more like the bad version of himself.
Yeah. He seems to start settling for the jumpers when he's not finishing at the rim. And even back to the Oklahoma City days, but the 18 footer used to be a lot more reliable back in the day. But now it's just like, I think all of his issues stem from just the diminished burst at the rim, explosiveness, and he's just, I mean, he used to be elite as a guard finisher. Now it is crazy for me to see him like getting to the rim and then like, where can I find this outlet pass? As he's already in the air, it's led to the turnovers. I mean, what is the number through three games, turnover wise?
He's got 20 turnovers.
Yeah, and that's
to 15 assists.
I mean, so, you know, as bad as the shooting percentage is, like 20 turnovers, like that's just wasted offensive possessions, giveaway offensive possessions. You could basically add that to the missed shots. Then we're basically talking about a guy who's been successful on like 10% of offensive possessions. Again, preseason, three games. But it's the trends that have been concerning with Russ over the last few years. And you're right. I mean, he's hit monster stretches in Washington and monster stretches in Houston. But like, Houston had to rearrange how they played entirely. They had to strip centers from the floor. They, you know, he basically became their center. And then in Washington, it was just like kind of a weird down the stretch type situation where they're like, Russ, just go do whatever you want at all times, like gobble up as much stats as possible and try to get us to the play-in. That's not really what the Lakers need out of that spot. The Lakers need, you know, the off-ball cutting, some spacing, some really like locked-in perimeter defense that they're missing with Caruso and Caldwell Pope gone. And I mean, the reason why I'm just very down on the fit is because I think Russell Westbrook has proven that that's not Russell Westbrook. So that's as we talk about preseason concerns, that's the only one I have about the Lakers, but that is a huge one I have about the Lakers.
I think on the flip side, LeBron and AD look really good. And, there's a question posed to Frank Vogel last night of sort of alluding to Russ's struggles and the fact that the Lakers might have to heavily lean on LeBron and AD in the early portion of the season. They already have a couple injuries. Talen Horton Tucker's out 4+ weeks. Trevor Ariza's out 8+ weeks. So two hits to the perimeter rotation, the perimeter defense. And I think AD has progressively looked better, in my opinion. He's been playing closer to the basket. His jump shot is still a little rusty. He's still kind of finding his rhythm with that, but 20 free throw attempts in his last two games, which is really encouraging after averaging the second fewest free throw attempts of his career last season. And it almost seemed like at times he kind of got in his head a little bit where he was shooting in the mid 60s from the free throw line. And he kind of started to shy away from contact and going into the charity stripe. So I think for him to kind of be more aggressive again, shooting free throws better, that's an encouraging sign. He had a couple lobs last night, which we just didn't really see from him, you know, last season that consistently. Like if you go back and look at some of his highlights, like a lot of it is that face up, you know, turnaround jumpers, not as much stuff at the rim and dunking on people. We saw that last night. And then LeBron, I mean, he had that 30-second stretch where he scored 6 points in transition and was just an absolute freight train. The guy that we just see year after year frighten people when he's going to the rim. So I think as, you know, I think the rust thing is going to figure itself out one way or another, right? You know, I think right now it hasn't looked great, but I think reason for optimism for the Lakers is LeBron and AD are still LeBron and AD. And I think you put those two, like even last night, they were the only two starters that had a positive plus minus and the other three guys all were negative. And like, that to me is just kind of the story of the Lakers. You put those two guys out there, they're going to, doesn't matter who the other three guys are, you're going to have productive lineups. You're probably going to win those minutes. So to me, it's just about finding the balance with lineups. What's the best group to put around LeBron? What's the best group to put around AD? And until Russ kind of finds his bearings, let's ride these two into really an easy early stretch of the schedule where the Lakers could go 7-3, 8-2, something like that. So I think that's kind of going to be the early season formula for LA.
Juan, you mentioned the injuries to Ariza and THT, which, I mean, just to say nothing of Nunn and Monk and Wade Ellington, who are all dealing with minor things. But if we focus on the two that we know are going to be longer term injuries, Ariza and Horton Tucker, those are, you know, arguably, or maybe not even arguably at this point, two of the Lakers' most important, you know, defensive perimeter defenders. Which one of those injuries are you more, and listen, neither of them are going to keep them out, you know, past the new year, we don't think. Like this, you know, THT is going to be reevaluated in 4 weeks. I think they said 8 weeks for Ariza, which would put him at sort of early December. And I mean, we all know that reevaluated doesn't mean back on the court, but like it sometimes does. So which of those injuries do you think is going to hamstring the Lakers most in the early going?
I think it's Ariza, if only because I think it potentially changes the way they play, because they, I think as you reported a couple weeks ago at this point, you know, the Lakers projected starting lineup was AD, Ariza at the four, LeBron, Wayne Ellington, and Russ. I think Ariza being out of the equation makes the Lakers almost have to start big, because the alternative is, I think, starting Melo, right? Or going super small, going with LeBron at the four, maybe Bays and Ellington on the wings. But I don't think I don't think LeBron wants to commit to that yet. And I think part of the Ariza thing, what was sort of bridging the gap where he could kind of handle some of those tougher forward assignments and save LeBron's legs for offense. So I don't think the Lakers are going to go in that super small direction. So maybe it is starting Melo, although I think there's a lot of defensive concerns with that. But
oh,
I think
baby,
most likely
Melo and Russ.
Most likely it is DeAndre. I think, you know, all signs are pointing to, even from the first couple days of training camp, DeAndre was logging reps with the starters. That was kind of one of the first storylines to come out.
I got a question though. Dwight Howard's better than DeAndre Jordan at this point.
Yes.
In their careers.
Yeah. Here's my response to that. I think that Dwight Howard as a backup, kind of in and out of the lineup, you know, having a role some nights, not having a role other nights, is a known commodity. Dwight embraced that role for this team 2 years ago and they won a championship. You know, his energy off the bench was a huge part of what made the Lakers so dynamic. I say 2 years ago. I mean, it's more like 9 minutes ago, but 1 year and 2 days ago was the last time that team played together. So I think, you know, I think that they know they can trust Dwight in that role. DeAndre, the reason he's here is that he left Brooklyn because he wasn't going to be able to play. Like
he has good friends in the NBA. DeAndre Jordan is a great friend, apparently. That's what he's, sorry.
But to keep him engaged and to keep him motivated, I don't know that if you swapped those two, you would get the same contributions that you get by letting DeAndre be the nominal starter, letting Dwight play the other half of the big minutes there, and letting, you know, AD play his 15, 18 minutes a game at center.
Yeah. To your earlier question, Bill, on, you know, Ariza obviously, I think strategically is a more concerning injury for what Jovan mentioned, but also just like Talen Horton-Tucker just kind of hurt his thumb and he's what, 20, 21 years old now. Yeah. And like, you know, he could run and probably keep in good physical shape and be fine in 4 or 5 weeks to just kind of hit the ground running. Trevor Ariza, like, kind of sounds like a pretty difficult ankle injury he's going to be going through. And you're talking like, what's Ariza now? 36, 37?
36. Yeah. He'll be 37 in June. So like he'll be 36 this year.
You just start to worry about what his season will look like even once he's back. I mean, the type of shape he'll be in and how little basketball he's played. Because I remember that was a big thing with the Heat, how much of a hiatus he had had before that. And, like, the idea of Trevor Ariza is very helpful to LeBron, is very helpful to the Lakers. But I just wonder if that idea will ever formulate on the court. And if it doesn't, I mean, LeBron can prefer to have a big wing that can help him defensively, but we all know, like, when this season matters, they can't really be playing DeAndre Jordan a bunch of minutes. Like, so
no. And honestly, one of my pet peeves, historically is just the token starter. I really don't like it, you know, cause you know what, when I covered the Clippers, they had like Marcin Gortat, who was just completely washed at that point. And he was,
wow, that is somebody I haven't thought about for a while. No, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you.
They had this weird like three center rotation where it was Gortat, Boban, and Trez. And Boban and Trez were both better and more effective than Gortat, but for some reason they just liked him better in the starting group. And they were kind of wasting like 15 minutes a night with Gortat, and all the lineup data backed it up and the eye test backed it up. And it was just like, why are you doing this? And I feel like, to be honest, and you know, you guys could disagree with me if you want. I think DeAndre has been the worst rotation player. Of the 14 guys on the roster, I think DeAndre has been the eye test wise to me is probably been the worst. I know the lineup data would say Melo actually, but I think Austin Reeves has been better than DeAndre Jordan. He'll have the one or two highlights a game where he'll get a dunk in transition or he'll block a shot. But if you actually look at possession by possession, Dwight and AD are just at a totally different level in defending the pick and roll and in contesting shots, altering shots. Dwight is, I think, more effective around the rim, just on both ends. And obviously AD, I mean, we don't need to really compare anybody to AD, but like, I just think DeAndre, you know, if they're going to go big, I would prefer Dwight at this point. I think there's enough of a gap between them to negate any preference of Dwight coming off the bench. But I do think the way things are lining up, it is going to be DeAndre for better or worse.
So here's a thought on that also. Like, DeAndre Jordan is a 34-year-old, you know, former All-Star on a minimum contract. Like, it may not work out. And if it doesn't work out, it's at a cost to the Lakers. You know, you go big at the beginning of the year as a necessary function of who's available. Maybe you get Ariza back and you figure out that you're better off small, and maybe you cut DeAndre loose if it doesn't work out. I mean, we are at the, you know, it's hard to remember always each year because, like, you know, the rotation does matter, by the way, and the early season rotation is telling of how, you know, the coaching staff views this team. But it's entirely possible that, you know, DeAndre Jordan, we saw this with JaVale McGee, right? Like, JaVale was the starter for the entire regular season, you know, 2 years ago, really 1 year ago. And then he, you know, barely played in after the first round of the playoffs. And so these things evolve. And so, you know, if DeAndre's the starter on opening night, it doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, the Lakers are stuck with him in that position all year if it's not working.
Yeah, all you need to know about DeAndre Jordan, though, is just what happened at his last stop, which was obviously he got paid over market value because Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant wanted him on the Nets. And then Kenny Atkinson essentially lost the locker room, or at least lost the Kevin Durant, Kyrie portion of the locker room, because he benched DeAndre Jordan because he's like, Jared Allen is much better. And then Steve Nash arrives and they again try to fit DeAndre Jordan in the rotation. And by the end of last year,
they dumped Jared Allen.
Yeah, really by the middle of last season, though, it was like Bruce Brown and non-center lineups make more sense. Jeff Green is a small ball big. Let's bring Blake Griffin in here. He matters more. LaMarcus Aldridge, let's try him. And by this summer, they cut, you know, a team that had two of his best friends in the league who basically run that franchise in a lot of ways. They just cut DeAndre Jordan, which to me says where DeAndre Jordan is as a player. And it's the confusing part of this offseason from the Lakers. I actually understand it because, like, you know, we talk about players having control. Obviously, it's like LeBron wants Russell Westbrook. LeBron, I'm sure, like, you know, all of them believe maybe they can pull out prime DeAndre. I shouldn't say prime DeAndre Jordan, but maybe late prime DeAndre Jordan. But it's just, to me, just like a young big would make more sense. I mean, would Devontae Kaycock, who's Jones. Now on the next? Yeah, Damian Jones, there you go. But I mean, just mean Marc Gasol is a great name who they had under contract. Which, oh, I mean,
if you want me, I've got opinions on Marc Gasol. If you guys want to talk about
to go
it.
Off the rails,
stretch and get down on the blocks.
I'm just saying, like, to me, as you look at all their veteran signings, a lot of them were good. You know, Bazemore had a good year. I think Ariza was a good swing. Even Carmelo, like, he did some stuff on Portland to make you believe, hey, he could come in and in the right role help. But Westbrook, I think, starting to look more and more like a swing and a miss. And then DeAndre Jordan, I'm like, that should just go to a center that's more capable of helping. Because I understand the idea of wanting a big, you know, in some lineups. I just don't think he's at all the correct big to try to, you know, fit in those lineups.
Another big, yes, but also another big who understands that he's not going to play every night and who is comfortable with that and is going to be able to summon the necessary energy. And I don't know, maybe DeAndre has the same sort of revelation that Dwight had in his first year with the Lakers. And he is more comfortable in that sort of role. We'll see. But like, I mean, we haven't seen it up to this point.
But the thing is, he's taken minimized role and he just hasn't been good in minimized roles.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Like, you know, Blake Griffin went to Brooklyn and just did the minimized role thing better than DeAndre Jordan. And, you know, again, that's the problem is, like, I think DeAndre Jordan will accept a minimized role. I just don't think he's going to be good in it.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
We talked about Russ and DJ as two guys who I think that there's still some concerns with the fit and the Lakers kind of figuring out their roles. I think one guy who has stood out to me in a positive way is Kent Bazemore. And you alluded to him. Frank mentioned him earlier in training camp as a guy who had started to, you know, stand out defensively and sort of distance himself from the perimeter group. And Kent, to me, has really been, I think, arguably the winner of the preseason from the Lakers' perspective because, you know, to me, like, we talked about his role as potentially the starting shooting guard or at least like a energy wing off the bench who would have a defensive role, but he's done that. He shot the ball well from three. I think he's fit in and, you know, he has some weaknesses. He tends to foul a lot. I don't love when he tries to play make or you know, kind of ISO and create for himself in the mid range.
Sound like a Warrior fan right now,
but
you're correct.
but aside from those,
Jovan, you know, Beha, Bay Area,
there you go.
He'll have a. Oh, I got a gift from Zoom. Running out of time, we've removed the 40-minute time limit.
What a gift!
Podcast all day.
there's some limitations there, right? And he's not perfect, but I do think we've seen him be a good point of attack defender, use his length against Chris Paul. We've seen him kind of just flying around as a help guy and just sort of randomly rotating and swiping at guys and getting into passing lanes. I think he really fits in with their transition game and just kind of what they're trying to do offensively. So I think Kent is, to me, locked up a starting spot, whether they go big or small. And I think he's working his way into arguably being the fourth most important Laker. I don't, like, that kind of sounds
that's
crazy,
a concern.
It might be true. I don't know.
Sounds like the Warriors team last year. The Warriors wanted him back, though. I mean, it is a very good signing by the Lakers at that price. Because late in the season, it's always referenced up here, but the Warriors went 15-5 down the stretch. That was when Wiseman got hurt, but also forgotten within there is Kelly Oubre screws up his thumb. And his wrist, and Kent Bazemore takes over the starting spot, and they went 15-5 down the stretch with Kent Bazemore starting at the two. And that's because he provided a lot of what Oubre did as like a long disruptive wing defender, as you're talking about, reliable, foul prone, but sometimes that, you know, that pisses opposing teams off too. Like, dude, this guy's just hacking me all game. Like, he just gets guys out of rhythm. But also, like, while he does get a little ambitious in transition at times and he can like drive into traffic, mostly he knows how to play offense. He knows how to play off the ball. He will, you know, he's good in corners. I think it's the left corner. If you look historically, he's like elite as a left corner shooter. And he's a good personality too. He's respected. You can tell he's respected by a lot of veterans in the league. Steph Curry loves him. It's one of his best friends. So yeah, I mean, that is one of their better offseason signings, and it seems like they realized that early. It almost seems like from me reading you guys, it almost seems like they were surprised that he was as good as he was.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because the way it was reported when he signed was that he signed with the Lakers for, you know, a big role. And I was really curious what that meant, especially as the roster took shape, because, you know, I think, you know, you could argue that he makes sense, you know, theoretically as a starter, but like, you know, Wayne Ellington, it's probably their purest shooter. And that's such a gaping hole, but like, and Jovan and I've talked about this, you know, offline, you know, really since the end of free agency, what you do with that two guard spot, you know, whether it was THT, and for various reasons, the answer there is no. Is it Wayne Ellington? And do you sacrifice the perimeter defense? I mean, the only guy who really checks the boxes that you need to a high enough degree, you know, is Kent Bazemore. And like, you know, the fact that he can shoot it, the fact that he does defend, you know, I would not be surprised at all if at some point this season, if the Lakers do start Ellington at the two, if at the start of the year, if the defensive liability becomes, you know, so great that that they need to switch some things around and try to get Bazemore in there. Because as it is, like, if we project a lineup of Westbrook, Ellington, LeBron, AD, and a center, I don't know who's guarding, you know, who's guarding the ball. I don't know who you're putting on Lillard and CP. And like, it goes like Westbrook is like in theory going to be the disruptive force there, but like, for all the reasons we've talked about, you're going to lose a lot if you're asking Russell Westbrook to be your primary backcourt defender.
I know he's not as big as Ariza, but you could play Ellington, Bazemore, LeBron at your like 2-3-4, and then
start AD, or bring AD off the bench as the sixth man and just start DeAndre.
There you go.
DeAndre's time.
Lob City.
I mean, that was my preferred starting lineup. What was the Ellington, Bazemore? I felt it gave you the defender, it gave you the shooter.
You just lose a lot of size. It's not a lot of size. You lose the 3 inches that Ariza has. Like Ariza, you know, Ariza plays more like a four at this point in his career, and you know, is probably a more physical defender, and can give you a little bit more, you know, inside the 3-point line as well. But Bazemore, I mean, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's absolutely an argument for that lineup. If you are stubbornly going to try to go small, which maybe that's the right choice, and you just don't play DeAndre Jordan, but. I just don't think that's the direction they're going at this point.
Well, one thing on that is the Lakers have already basically switched away from having Russell Westbrook be a point of attack defender. I mean, if you saw them, who like the defensive matchups against the Warriors, they were putting Russ on Damian Lee, and it was kind of whoever's the weakest, you know, Warriors offensive player on the perimeter, that's who they were hiding Russ on. And it was Bazemore taking the primary assignment of a Jordan Poole. In the previous matchup, they started Russ on Steph, but eventually switched him off and put Bazemore on him after Russ was struggling to get around screens. So I think already, you know, to me, just based on how they've been playing defensively and matching up, I think it's clear they're trying to hide Russ on whoever is the worst offensive player on the perimeter. We're going to put Russ there, have him be a helper. But we're not going to, you know, if a guy's going through screens or handling the ball a lot, we do not want Russ on that guy. And there will be teams that challenge that, right? Like I think the actualized version of the Warriors in theory with Klay and Jordan Poole and Steph out there, there isn't really a place to hide once those guys are 100%. So I think that's one interesting thing. And quickly, we mentioned Ellington defensively. He's impressed me with his ability to chase and get around screens. I think he's arguably been the best Laker in that regard in terms of just that one specific defensive thing. I think overall he's not a good defender, but he can get around screens on offense and he can get around screens on defense. And then Dwight's been a revelation to me. He's his rim protection, his offensive rebounding, his finishing, and just that nuisance that he is of just getting under opponent's skins.
He's gotten like seven scuffles with like seven different Warriors players.
He was going to kill Bielitsa last night.
Oh my God, Bielitsa. You can tell Bielitsa's out there like, dude, preseason, can we calm down a little bit?
Why is Bielitsa talking like Mario all of a sudden? Like,
have you talked to Bielitsa?
I haven't, but is that what he sounds like?
I mean,
it was, but
it Dwight, was a bad impression.
Bill, I was like imagining Dwight on last year's team, and I was like, if they had this guy instead of Drummond or Trez, like that, I was just like, wow, this like, there's something about being in a Lakers uniform for Dwight the second and third time around versus the first time, and Rondo, where like those two guys are just so much more effective as Lakers than they are in any other jersey.
Well, they're so much more engaged. I had to chuckle. Our friend Keith Pompey from the Philadelphia Inquirer had a tweet a couple weeks ago, like after the 76ers first preseason game. And he was like, you know, my hot take of the preseason is that Andre Drummond is going to be a much better backup center for the 76ers than Dwight Howard was. And I'm like, listen, that may be true. And maybe that's a better fit for Drummond, but like the Lakers are not second guessing that decision whatsoever after the Drummond disaster and having seen Dwight, you know, kind of pick up where he left off at the end of at the end of the bubble. I've two things, because I think we need to bring this back around to the Warriors in opening night before we get out of here. But Jovan, you just said an amazing sentence, which was talking about the Warriors, who you described as Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Jordan Poole. Jordan Poole has had a spectacular preseason, and he does look like the third Splash Brother. And I just need to ask you, Slater, like,
they,
you know,
call it
like
the pool party up here.
I was gonna ask, okay, because like this is my thing. This is like my whole life and my reason for being.
You would enjoy the pool renaissance. So.
when you have the like finally the Splash Brothers have a pool. I didn't know. I'm glad that they people are ahead of me on it.
He is being tagged as the perfect Splash cousin because, you know, you have the pool party.
He is the pool.
Yes. He has had a crazy preseason. To the fact, I'm curious to see him opening night as we maybe shift the conversation to opening night. It is going to be an interesting, you know, mini test case for like how much we do or don't overrate and overvalue preseason. Cause you know, you mentioned the Lakers struggles and they're up to 0-5. The Warriors are 4-0 and like look great. And like even last night with like not Steph and Draymond, like they just played really kind of like flowing basketball. And obviously Jordan Poole's kind of had these games, but the way Bielitsa and Porter have just fit into what Kerr wants to do. And the fact that the style they play offensively, I think, is tricky for a Lakers team that doesn't really just want to like chase guys off ball. And Steph Curry's scattering over here and Poole's doing down screens. And you mentioned the back cuts where the miscommunication happens. And as the Lakers just try to discover who they are with this just new, completely new roster, essentially around LeBron AD. If, you know, in a vacuum, and certainly if you were to say they were going to meet in the playoffs, I'm favoring the Lakers. I think they're much more powerful. They'll really bruise the Warriors inside. But on opening night, considering what these two teams look like in preseason, I'm very curious to see if the lights go on and the Lakers are just like, no, we're bigger, we're better, we actually care tonight, we're going to dominate this game. Or if it's just like what we've seen in preseasons, like what's going to play out opening night.
Yeah, I think, and that's where I'm at with the preseason in terms of, I reject the premise that it doesn't matter. I just think,
hell yeah,
we've seen
hell
it.
Yeah.
We've seen it time and time again matter. And like, I even think of, you know, two examples with these two teams, that 2012-13 Lakers team that didn't win a game in the preseason.
And 0-8. Do you know how hard it is to lose 8 preseason games when like half the teams you're playing aren't trying?
And I went back and looked and 5 of them were by double digits, and they had some blowout losses where it wasn't like they just were, you know, squeaking by in close games, barely losing. And, you know, a lot of times in preseason, you put your bench guys in the fourth quarter. And, you know, like last night, Lakers probably win if they stick with their normal rotation. But maybe, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe it was a close game. But I think some of that's a little bit inflated by like putting the bench warmers in the fourth quarter. But you had that example, and then you have, I don't know their exact preseason record, but the year the Warriors went 67-15, won their first title, I remember them steamrolling through the preseason. And it was like, and there was kind of the talk of like, is this real? Is this sustainable? And all of a sudden they just reel off all these wins and become this dominant juggernaut that wins multiple championships. And again, it's not to say like the Lakers are in trouble. I just think this is a measure of where they're currently at. And it would not surprise me at all if they did lose on opening night. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I think with what we've seen, it's hard to find a lot of positives with where they're currently at. Now, I think the early stretch of schedule is easy. That should help them kind of withstand some of these lumps that they're going to take. But I'm fascinated by it. And I do think that the Warriors are a bit of a matchup problem with Steph and just some of the way with their 3-point shooting and the way that the Lakers are going to have to defend them, like with the back cuts and with the flare screens and stuff like that. Like, you really have to be in tune defensively.
And their strategy too, like they're watching the film like we are, and they're going to say like, well, whoever like Russell Westbrook's on, like just run around a bunch of screens until he makes a mistake and that breaks the defense down. So like, they're going to scheme up believing that the Lakers are going to be kind of disjointed defensively opening night. And if the Lakers can prove, look, the game matters tonight, we're, Russell Westbrook is going to care. We are going to be on a string. Frank Vogel does it because the Lakers also know what the Warriors are doing, right? That's the NBA in a lot of ways, but it's early interesting test for the Lakers.
I do think, Jovan, you mentioned the soft start to the schedule. I have to think that's a factor in how the Lakers have handled the preseason. They know not only is it a long season, but they're going to have some room for error in the first month of the season. 12 of the first 15 are at home. They play the Rockets twice. They play the Hornets in there, but like there's worse teams too. There's another bad team that they play twice. I just think that there's going to be opportunities for them to kind of figure things out on the fly and not have to pay that much of a price. So I think, LeBron and AD and Russ have played one game together. Maybe that's two by the end of the preseason, with the game Thursday night. No, that is not enough, I don't think. But you know what? Get through the Warriors game and get through the Suns game in game two, and it gets a lot easier. So I just think that there is a little bit of long range strategy here with the way they've approached it, especially with it such a veteran team.
Here, you have at San Antonio, at OKC.
Yeah, you got the Spurs twice.
Home Cleveland, home Houston, home Houston, home OKC. And then later in that 15-game stretch, you have Minnesota and San Antonio at home. So that's like 8-0.
That's a gift from the NBA right there. That's a gift from the NBA. That is cake. I didn't know it was that easy.
Right. But the first two are Golden State and Phoenix, the teams they have played twice in the preseason and lost to twice. So that's going to be – and the last two teams they played last season with the play-in and the first round. So those two games –
those two games are going to do a lot of narrative shaping for the Lakers or the early stretch of the season. If they go 0-2,
I think they want to split. I think they want to split in those two. However you get it. Yeah. Are you?
Well, they've lost 5 straight games to Phoenix.
I'm not saying that I'm going to
put them on the barbecue right away.
I'm not necessarily saying it's going to shape the way I shape the narrative necessarily. I just think that, with the people who speak very loudly in the box hanging on my wall, that is going to be something that that's going to be the Lakers are in trouble. They're 0-2. They're not as good as the Suns or the Warriors yet. You can really set the tone of being the favorite you should be with those two games. It will evolve over the course of the season. But like in terms of how we talk about the Lakers in the early going of the season, those are going to be the two games that determine it. Cause you're not going to learn as much from those Cavs, Rockets, Thunder, Spurs games that Jovan just rattled off.
I think it's a great chance for LeBron and Davis, but really Davis to just like make a claim that like, yeah, we're unorganized. Yeah. We haven't come together as a team, but I'm bigger than everyone on the Warriors. I'm going to get 38-13 and LeBron's going to be dominant in transition. And, maybe they don't blow the Warriors out, but like, we're just going to physically drag this team across the finish line and beat it because we're the two best players on the floor tonight, and then go to Phoenix and do the same thing. That would be that's the type of statement that, like you said, that might shape a narrative a little bit. Cause you're like, well, this is probably as bad as the Lakers are going to be essentially. But these two are just these two.
Do we think, I don't know if we're going to podcast again before that Suns game. We probably will, but I just got to get this in while I'm thinking of it. What are the odds? Like, what are the Vegas odds on whether or not Anthony Davis kicks Jay Crowder in the groin in that game?
What would you set him at?
I mean, I'd say it's like
the first quarter too, because I think both times in the first quarter.
I mean, I'd say it's probably like plus 200. Like, I think there's, I think the odds are, I think it would be a slight, chance that the slight favorite that it's not going to happen, but like, you know, the odds aren't terrible that it does. So I'd probably put a few bucks on Jay Crowder getting kicked in the groin by Anthony Davis. It's just a trend. It's a theme. We've seen it too many times. By the way, there's a sports book at the Footsteps Arena now. So you could probably get that action.
At MGM, that's the only one I know.
Is it Footsteps, Footprints? What the hell's the name of the arena
Footprint,
now?
Footprint, I think, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know. I need to do the circuit again and see all the different
It's a whole new league out there, man. Like, it's wild. And they've changed the pickup table for credentials at Staples Center for the first time in my 9 years covering the league. Like, I mean, this is, I'm concerned about the direction of things, to be honest.
I'm going to go, I don't know if this is contrarian necessarily, but I think the Phoenix game to me is more telling in that, again, like, they've lost five times in a row to them now, including, you know, the last three games of the playoffs, two preseason games. And that to me, like, I just kind of want to see some dog from the Lakers, you know, like, come out and, because I think they have some similar advantages. Obviously, DeAndre Ayton has stepped up and I think is playing at like an all-star caliber, you know, was playing at an all-star caliber.
Would you say he's playing at a max level? Because that's the big question.
I would give him the max based on the way he looked in
but that. But you don't have Robert Sarver's pocket.
I don't, but
that could make that situation weird, by the way.
I want to see that from the Lakers. And if they lose opening night, but they come out and beat the Suns, like, that to me is still probably a net positive because that game to me, I think, matters more. It's also, frankly, until we see what Klay Thompson looks like, the Suns are the bigger threat to them, right? So I think
I picked the Suns to win the West. So yeah, I agree.
Still? Or like this yeah. season, you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm agreeing for they're like the stiffer early season test.
Is there anything else we didn't touch on, guys?
Probably, but it's a long season. I mean, there's a lot of questions with this team. There's a lot of things we need to figure out and you know, along the way. But I think, you know, we know what the big questions are, and it's, you know, we're kind of getting to a point where we're going to start seeing some of the answers, at least in the early going, but it's going to keep evolving. And, you know, I mean, I think last year is such a great example of, like, you know, what we think we know going into a season and how it changes over the course of a year. And then ultimately how much it all mattered. Like, I mean, last year was obviously a very peculiar season for a variety of reasons, but, you know, it comes down to, are LeBron and Anthony Davis, you know, healthy and playing at their best by the time the playoffs get here. And there are a whole lot of things that we couldn't possibly predict at this point that will determine that when we get there. So, you know, I kind of roll my eyes every time the Lakers talk about being a long season and being a marathon and not wanting to skip steps. But, like, really the only thing that really matters for this team is, like, not falling apart, you know, over the course of the 82 game regular season, and then everybody sort of being on the same page and having used those 82 games to figure each other out, being healthy and, you know, giving yourself the best chance in the playoffs.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to wrap it up.
In conclusion, nothing you're seeing right now matters. We'll podcast again in April.
I mean, that we got to keep the listeners hooked. But we will be back next week. I think after, we'll talk about it after the podcast, but I think after the first game, we'll do our weekly edition and kind of tap in after that. But thank you guys for listening. I know this podcast has been sporadic, but we will go back to our regularly scheduled once a week, and I'll be doing some post-game pods. So be on the lookout for that. Thank you for your patience. And for Bill and Anthony, I'm Jovan. Signing off.
We back, baby!
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.